pressing for the current system to evolve from a single-party system to a multi-party democracy is a very, very dangerous thing for anyone in China to be doing.
Examining China's treatment of dissidents. It's Tuesday, July 18th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're online, too. Check us out on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, South Korea proposes military talks with the North, paying for new Philippines infrastructure, China's economy showing growth and caution, healthy soil, a phone booth to learn about immigrants. It's all on today's VOA Asia. A prominent Chinese rights activist, Xu Xiyang, has been released after serving a 4-year sentence for gathering a crowd to disturb public order. Xu, who co-founded the New Citizens Movement, was freed on Saturday, just 2 days after pro-democratic advocate and Nobel Peace Laureate Liu Xiaobo died after a brief struggle with liver cancer. The ashes of the 61-year-old Liu were scattered Saturday at sea. The fate of his wife, Liu Xia, who's been under house arrest for 7 years, is not clear. The head of the Washington-based non-governmental organization Freedom Now, Jared Genser, tells VOA's Victor Beatty he's not sure there's any link between the two cases.
China is obviously a massive country with 1.4 billion people, and unfortunately these days there are thousands of dissidents who are detained in various ways. Even high-profile dissidents in the past, in my experience, have been actually released at the end of their sentences. And so in that sense, his release probably is more aptly tied to the expiration of his 4 years in prison than anything else. I'm quite confident that, you know, given the way that the Chinese tend to treat people like him who are recently released, he will be under very close surveillance, not able to talk to the media, and have very, very limited contact with the outside world.
He was part of this New Citizens Movement, which advocates working within the system to press for change. Is that possible?
I don't think that there is any current evidence that would suggest that that's possible. I think that, sadly, the death of Liu Xiaobo, if it were to stand for anything, it's that standing up against the system and doing so in a way that advocates pressing for the current system to evolve from a single-party system to a multi-party democracy is a very, very dangerous thing for anyone in China to be doing.
Well, Jared, you were intimately involved in the case of Liu Xiaobo, the Nobel laureate, who lost his battle with cancer last Thursday. His ashes scattered at sea. Were you surprised by that?
Sadly, I wasn't. I mean, I was horrified and incredibly saddened, but I wasn't surprised. I, unfortunately, was reaching out urgently to many governments and telling them I was very, very worried when we lost touch with Liu Xia about 48 hours before Liu Xiaobo's death, that the moment that we learned he had died, that they might want to disappear the body or do something of this practical equivalent. They obviously did not want to have a gravesite where people, including the family and friends, but let alone Chinese people more broadly, would be able to visit his grave, given what he stood for and symbolized. He spent no time near oceans in his life. And so under these circumstances, it's quite clear that the family was intensely pressured to cremate him and dispose of his remains at sea. And I think that that's part and parcel of the pressure that Liu Xia has been under since she was detained within hours after the announcement of the 2010 Nobel Peace Prize in October 2010. And she has and continues to be under house arrest, despite that being illegal under Chinese law. There has not been contact restored with her counsel or with her close friends since Liu Xiaobo died. And of course, I'm urging all governments around the world to put intense pressure on the government of China to allow her to be free.
Jared Genser said China's harsh treatment of Liu Xiaobo and his wife underscores the weakness of the one-party system in China. He also said it has raised international respect for Liu, his wife, and what they've stood for. Genser says you can kill a man, but not his idea. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. South Korea proposes military talks with North. EU weighs new North Korea sanctions after missile test. 6 killed as Indian and Pakistan soldiers trade fire in Kashmir. China denounces Taiwan provision in U.S. defense bill. Indonesia's parliament speaker named corruption suspect. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. South Korea proposed military talks and family reunions with North Korea on Monday to reduce the increasing potential for conflict over Pyongyang's continued development of nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles. Seoul's Vice Defense Minister Seo Ju-suk announced the proposed meeting on Monday.
국방부는 군사 분계선에서
He says the defense ministry proposes to hold a military talk between the two Koreas on July 21st at Tonglagok in North Korea to stop all hostile actions, which heightens military tensions at the border. Tonglagok is a North Korean building at the Panmunjom Truce Village on the border used in the past for inter-Korea talks. The last government-level meetings were held in December 2015. Since South Korean President Moon Jae-in took power in May, his government has tried to engage the North to reduce tensions, including offers of humanitarian aid, non-political exchanges, and reviving the inter-Korean military hotline that Pyongyang cut off in early 2016 after Seoul shut down the jointly run Kaesong Industrial Complex to punish the North for its nuclear testing and long-range rocket launches. But so far, the Kim Jong-un government has rejected most of these overtures. Analysts say South Korea may be willing to suspend loudspeaker broadcasts at the border that are highly critical of the North Korean leader to reestablish contact. Daniel Pinkston, a North Korea analyst with Troy University in Seoul.
And once that's established, then both sides can understand what the other is seeking. They can signal to the other side what they want, what their problems or issues they have with the other side.
North Korea has called for the suspension of South Korea-U.S. joint military exercises, but Pinkston said that's unlikely, given Pyongyang's repeated ballistic missile launches, including the July 4th test of what some experts say was an intercontinental ballistic missile with a potential range to reach Alaska, although the United States disputes this claim. The South Korean Red Cross on Monday also proposed holding talks in August with the North to arrange reunions of family members separated during the 1950 through 53 Korean War, with the hope of scheduling the reunions in October. Many of the estimated 60,000 South Koreans that have signed up to participate in these sporadically held inter-Korean reunions are elderly and have had virtually no contact with relatives living in the repressive North, where contact with the outside world is highly restricted. Seoul's Unification Ministry says these latest proposals are in line with President Moon Jae-in's dual-track policy to pursue both engagement with the Kim Jong-un government while also supporting U.S.-led sanctions to pressure Pyongyang to halt its nuclear and ballistic missile programs. We thank VOA Seoul correspondent Brian Padden, who contributed this story. Happening now in Asia, tropical storm Talas hits Vietnam's central provinces, causing flooding in Hanoi, and it has killed at least two people. China's southern island province of Hainan was first to be hit Sunday. The storm also caused a cargo ship with 13 crew members to sink off the Vietnamese coast. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're spending part of your day with us on VOA Asia. The Philippine president's ambitious $167 billion plan to build up infrastructure for long-term job creation and economic development will tap into his new friendship with China for funding, despite some doubts at home. President Rodrigo Duterte said his golden age of infrastructure would create roads, railways, and other public infrastructure through the end of his term in 2022. The Southeast Asian country, where about one-fifth of the people live in poverty, has missed factory investment, with it job creation, partly because of a lack of those amenities. China has offered the Philippines up to $24 billion in aid that includes such projects, part of a friendship that the two former rivals began pursuing after Duterte took office in June 2016. Previously, China and the Philippines angrily disputed tracts off the South China Sea. Beijing has taken an upper hand with land reclamation in the sea's Spratly Islands and Coast Guard patrols over a shoal coveted by Filipino fishermen. Song Seung-woon is a Southeast Asia specialized economist with the private banking unit of CIMB in Singapore.
it shouldn't be a surprise that the Philippines would be receiving more funding. The only thing, obviously, all these things will come with a catch. In the case of the Philippines, from the Chinese, is to get the Philippines on their side as far as the South China Sea claims over territory are concerned. But it does anchor the Philippines closer toward the Chinese.
A heftier infrastructure budget, which began growing in 2016 under Duterte's predecessor, Benigno Aquino, would build new ground transportation as well as expand ports and airports for use by foreign invested factories. Investors now pick places such as China and Vietnam because of their more developed facilities. The Philippines is also raising money through tax reform to fund new infrastructure. From July to May, the government collected about $41 billion in revenues. That's 7% higher than in the same period a year earlier. Over the past year, for example, Beijing has discussed helping fund two Philippine railway projects with a combined total cost of $8.3 billion. China agreed in January to work with the Philippines on 30 projects and put up the equivalent of $3.7 billion. Philippine pundits and opposition politicians have questioned that funding because they worry that Beijing would use it to erode their country's sovereignty claim and the fishing-rich, oil-laden South China Sea off their west coasts. Some also wonder whether China will send its own workers and materials for the projects it funds. Chinese-funded projects in other countries have come with Chinese labor, meaning fewer local jobs. Georgiana Hernandez is spokeswoman for separately elected Philippine Vice President Lenny Robredo.
The debate with regards to borrowing from China, I think, has some political overtones to it. But I think from a pure financial perspective, the cost of borrowing from China is not any cheaper or any more expensive than borrowing from the market. This is because borrowing from China is typically done through the Chinese policy banks. They're not a private bank, they're state-owned, so they're not going to charge you what you go to a bank and you come out of a loan.
Christian de Guzman, who is the vice president and senior credit officer with Moody's in Singapore. Philippine Senator Leila De Lima asked the Senate in May to examine any proposed loan from China that would rack up debt or compromise Philippine sovereignty. Beijing has made similar offers across Eurasia under its four-year-old Belt and Road Initiative aimed at increasing Chinese influence while picking up contracts for Chinese firms. Most Filipinos distrust China, according to a survey by Metro Manila research organization Social Weather Stations in the first quarter of 2017. But the Philippines will probably find China's loan terms equal to what private banks would offer. Brunei, Malaysia, and Vietnam also contest Beijing's claims to the 3.5 million square kilometer South China Sea, and they resent Chinese control of islets for military use, as well as its passage of Coast Guard vessels through waters overlapping their own claims. China has turned its $11.2 trillion economy to offer investment for all three, keeping their anger quiet, especially after a World Arbitration Court ruled last year, this month, that the legal basis for much of Beijing's maritime claims. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for sending us this story. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia: China's GDP outpaced expectations in the second quarter, with growth holding steady at 6.9%, despite worries that the world's number two economy would slow because of Beijing's efforts to contain major risks. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, more on China's economy. On Monday, it said that it had expanded its economy 6.9% in the second quarter between April and June on strong factory output, exports, and consumer spending. It's the same level of growth as the first quarter, although some economists expect a slowdown in the second half of the year. Shane Oliver, chief economist of AMP Capital in Sydney, tells VOA the generally held view was that the second quarter growth would slow to about 6.5%.
The clear message is that
the Chinese economy remains pretty robust. Yes, it's not the 10% plus growth rate we saw last decade, but the reality is that strong consumer spending, solid growth in industrial production and reasonable investment growth, particularly on the infrastructure front, is keeping the Chinese economy pretty strong.
Shane, you're expecting a slowdown in the last half of the year?
My feeling is, yes, that will slow down. The property market has cooled off a little bit. There has been some tightening up on the policy front, particularly from the central bank in China in recent months. So that should see some sort of slowdown, but I wouldn't get too excited about that. If that slowdown comes through, at worst, it probably takes us down to around 6.5%.
Shane Oliver tells us what's behind some of the strong numbers, including June factory output growth, the strongest since March, and June retail sales growth, the fastest since December 2015.
I think there's a bunch of things. One of them worth noting is that the global economy as a whole is stronger than was the case a year or two ago. That growth out of Europe, the US to some degree, Japan's a little bit healthier. So consequently, demand for Chinese manufactured goods is pretty solid, and that's pushed up factory output growth in China. On top of that, you've still got a bunch of infrastructure projects coming through. Now, a couple of years ago, the Chinese economy started to slow down a bit more than the authorities wanted. They started to ramp up infrastructure investment, airports, roads, rail, that sort of stuff. And that's also boosting factory output at present. And of course, on the retail sales front, I think that's just an ongoing story there. The global pressure on China is to consume more, but I doubt you're going to find a country with retail sales growth above 10%. In fact, the most recent number is 11%. So the bottom line is that the Chinese consumer is doing their job. So that's a good thing. But bottom line is that on both fronts, the investment side / industrial production, as well as the consumer side, the Chinese economy seems to be doing pretty well.
With China's stock market still relatively weak and a hot property market, the buildup of debt has swelled, according to one report, as much as 277% of gross domestic product, which Shane Oliver says represents some concerns for the Chinese economy.
There's certainly concerns around the Chinese economy. The debt issue is perhaps the biggest one. The problem in China is that they save too much. The Chinese economy puts aside in the form of saving about 45% of GDP each year. And that money is recycled through their banking system. And of course, when you shove money into the banking system, what does it do? It lends it out. And guess what? It's called debt. So a lot of that debt growth you're seeing in China reflects that massive savings rate. They need to consume more and save less. So I think that what you're seeing in terms of their debt growth is not quite as bad as it looks.
Shane Oliver said Chinese debt is about in the middle of debt levels among developed and emerging economies, although its debt level continues to rise quickly. And he said despite a hot property market, Chinese household debt is quite low, about 30-40% of gross domestic product than in the United States, where it hovers around 70%, or even Australia, which is above 100%. As for 2017 growth, he expects to raise his growth target for China from 6.5% to 6.7% or 6.8%. Developing at this hour in Asia, Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte says he will expedite passage of a draft bill that will make the southern predominantly Muslim island of Mindanao an autonomous region after talks with the island's rebel leaders. You'll get the top stories every day on VOA 60 and VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, take care of your soil, and your soil will take care of you. That's the message agriculture experts have for farmers worldwide. They say farmers can halt the degradation of their land and save money at the same time by using techniques known as conservation agriculture. But as VOA's Steve Barragona reports, adopting those techniques takes a change of attitude.
This is the vision of modern agriculture. Long rows of green crops on bare earth. Trey Hill's farm looks nothing like that.
If you don't like your fields to look like a mess, it has to kind of grow on you. Yet I have a lot of other owners and peers that are like, wow, what you're doing is really exciting.
What Hill is doing goes against millennia of farming practices. Most farmers everywhere till their fields. They leave soil bare in the off-season. Many plant the same crop year after year. But all three practices wear out the soil. And farms need to produce more to feed a growing population. So experts are backing something called conservation agriculture. It's the focus of a new book, Growing a Revolution. Author David Montgomery spoke to VOA by Skype.
These principles of conservation and agriculture flip all three of those ideas on their head. So it's a completely different philosophy to not till, to always have the ground covered with either a commercial crop or a cover crop, and to grow a much more diverse rotation.
Hill plants his crops into the remnants of the previous crop, no tilling. In the off-season, he blankets his fields with diverse cover crops. They hold on to the soil and its nutrients and prevent erosion. The cover crop is not for harvest, it's to feed the soil. University of Maryland soil scientist Ray Weil says these fields will do better in a drought.
This kind of cover, whether it's standing or down here, is going to drastically increase the amount of rain that soaks into the soil.
And Hill says this kind of farming is good for his bottom line. Less tilling means less tractor fuel. He buys less fertilizer because his cover crops feed the soil. He's not organic. He kills his cover crop with herbicides. But Weil says healthy soils do not have to be organic.
These soils are full of life. And I bet you can go into even a certified organic field. If it's been tilled, you'll never find those kind of things crawling around.
It's not perfect. Hill says these techniques sometimes create new problems.
Actually, this field was planted twice because the slugs ate the beans the first time. Obviously not very cost effective. Seeds expensive. Planters are expensive. Diesel's expensive. So it costs us a lot of money to learn. But we view it all as a learning process.
Experts are working to translate the successes for developing world farmers as climate change and growing populations raise the stakes for agriculture. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Rock Hall, Maryland.
Any first-time visitor to New York City will find the lights, crowds, and street performing action in Times Square a bit of a whirlwind experience. But if you stop, at the heart of it all, an unexpected art installation stands ready to transport you to any one of the city's five boroughs that more than 3 million immigrants call home, as we hear from VOA's Ramon Taylor.
If you're wandering through Times Square and you hear this,
the phone started ringing, so I picked it up.
Go with your instinct. On the other end may be a New Yorker waiting to tell you the story of how they got here.
We want to live better, and I didn't want my son to go to army also.
When you go to a place like Times Square, I think you tend to forget, because it's so dazzling. You tend to forget, like, I guess, who built all of this.
Afghan-American artist Aman Mojadidi partnered with Times Square Alliance to bring his latest installation, Once Upon a Place, to what's called the Crossroads of the World. More than 300,000 pedestrians pass through Times Square on any given day. At any one of these three repurposed phone booths, 70 oral histories of New York City immigrants
can be
heard.
Over there is just political secession is no good.
It makes something that was so iconic throughout the streets of New York come alive again in Times Square. And I also think that there's something about the juxtaposition of walking into a phone booth and having this private time with these very personal stories while you're amidst the chaos of Times Square that makes it a particularly unique experience.
Sierra Ward, a tourist from North Carolina, listened to a Tibetan immigrant whose story was like others she had heard.
I think it reminds everybody that, you know, a lot of people come here to get away from things, and, you know, it's a lot worse in other places than it is here.
While others marveled at the iconic relic that seldom exists anymore.
I feel like it's like a throwback to an older time, I guess. More when New York was a bit more gritty and a bit more like, I kind of think of like the 80s or something when I look at this.
But at the center of these stories is also a timeless reminder of New York and America's past and present as a city and country of immigrants. Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
We're glad you dialed us up on VOA Asia, and if you happen to be at the University of the Philippines in Diliman, dial us up on DZUP 1602 AM radio. You can hear us there. We thank them for carrying our program. You can also find our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Of course, we're on at our website, voanews.com, and on VOA Asia Facebook. We'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, John Ellison, managing editor, Diane Gao, our VOA Asia team, including Ali Ogden and David Byrd. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead.